Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is Ingrid Christensen, and she will be speaking on Dignity of Death. So, let's listen in on Ingrid talking about Dignity of Death.
I'd like to make a couple comments about this Carol Bly story.
I've got music coming in on here.
Before I begin it, I think the names are very important in this story. Therefore, I've listed them on the board behind me. All the people in the story are single, and it's interesting that the single people are arriving in the village in large numbers now in preparation for Singles Week, so I thought we would mention that at dinner. The characters are Jack, the funeral director, Molly, who is the extension teacher for the county, Bea, who is the dead end, Estonia and Marlon, who are sister and brother, and Momo, who is a mentally challenged person in the village. The subject of this story, I think, is very important, and I think maybe in our discussion after I read it, we may want to end up talking more about the things that this story evokes in us about our own lives than about the story itself, but that I will leave up to you to decide. The subjects are, the sort of things that are treated in this story are funerals, the legacy of death, what do we each leave when we have died, necrophilia, what being single means in the lives of especially Jack, Svea, and Molly, but also in the others. And where do we get our dignity? What is dignity? And what is, in terms of meaning of life, what about our dignity of life? I mean, the title of this short story is, of course, very important. The Dignity of Life by Carol Bly. One last little thing, dark and light, as in many short stories, it's also the case in this one, the dark and light things I think are important. Hope is also important. Two people stood quarreling in the casket showing room. They were a 63-year-old man named Marlon Huttila and his unmarried sister Estonia. She was so angry that she bent toward him from the end of her end of the coffin. "You really ought to keep your grimy hands out of that clean quilting," Estonia told him in a ferocious whisper. "As if you owned the place, and as if Svea weren't lying dead this very minute, right here in this very building, and you showing no respect." Jack Cannon, the funeral director, had been hovering near them. Now he gave a swift glance over to see how grimy Marlon's hands were. He would let this grown brother and sister quarrel a moment. He meant to leave this end of the long showing room so that they would not feel self-conscious as they whispered ferociously about prices. Marlon and Estonia were buying a casket and the service that went with it for their aunt, Svea Istava. An old woman who had come down in the world. Svea had died alone in her wreck of a place just north of St. Aidan, Minnesota. From the time she moved there in 1943 until she died in February 1982, she had always had a few faithful visitors. They would pick their way through her sordid front farmyard, avoiding the wet place and the coils of barbed wire. Her place was what was called inconvenient. That is, it had no water up to the house. But whenever someone visited, Mrs. Friesman to leave her idiot son Momo, or Jack Cannon, the funeral director, or on Sundays during the football season, her nephew, Marlon Huttila, Svea filled their cups with smoky coffee. Her most frequent visitor, Momo Friesman, found her dead. Next morning, people sitting around the Farrell Cafe traded information about Svea, making her a kind of random liturgy. They told one another how Svea had taken better care of that dog, Biscuit, than she took of herself. They told each other it was certainly hard to believe that Svea Istava had ever been the wife of a lieutenant colonel in the 45th field artillery whose body had not been sent home because that was during World War II, not Vietnam. Mrs. Breesman had seen his bronze star and his European theater of operations ribbon bar hanging on cup hooks in Svea's smudgy cupboard. Finally, people in the cafe settled to the most interesting thing about Svea. They said she was worth $500,000. In one booth, the sheriff was talking about her to the state patrolman who lived in Merrill Lake. The Merrill Lake man went past Svea's place nearly every day and had never seen such a dump. But the sheriff said that you could tell the true class of a person, though, by how they treated a dog. He himself had a handsome white shepherd bitch. That Biscuit now originally was a runt from one of his litters. He had taken it over to Svea because he knew she would make it a good home, and so she had. Everyone thought that Svea had left the whole 500,000, if she had any 500,000, to her nephew Marlon instead of half and half to Marlon and his sister Estonia. Marlon visited her once a week for years, whereas Estonia talked mean about Svea. Estonia, who ran the new St. Aidan Motel, was always roping in total strangers, finding out what they did and then asking their advice. With both elbows on the sign-in counter, her eyes trying to read their bank balances when they opened their checkbooks, her wrists supporting her cheeks, she would say, "So, you're a sales representative? As a sales representative, would you please tell me if this sounds right to you? I mean, you're in a position to know." Then she would explain about Svea's money going to her kid brother because he was a man and made up to her on Sunday afternoons. Recently, she had said to the new adult education teacher who stayed at the motel on Wednesday nights, "You're a humanities consultant? Now that sounds like something that has got to be about how people treat each other. Fairly or unfairly? Well, would you tell me, as a woman and as a humanities consultant, would you call it fair that this old woman who keeps her place so bad it is amazing they don't get the countryside nursing people in to spray around, do you think it is right she would leave all that money to my brother and not my half, to me? Estonia regarded the humanities consultant as another middle-aged woman like herself who had to have picked up some sense somewhere along the line. "I don't know if this is in your field or not, but just looking at it humanely, can you tell me that he is making any big sacrifices for his aunt when he can check on his Vikings and Steelers bets as good on Svea's 11-inch black and white as he could on his own remote control at home? Or maybe it's just me." As Marlon and Estonia stood around the casket showing room, Jack Cannon thought of everything that had happened since Svea's death. Her body had been discovered by Momo. Jack had quickly gone out to fetch it. He knew Momo as well as Svea because Momo liked dead bodies. There was scarcely a wake or visitation in the past 10 or 15 years at which Jack hadn't had a word with Momo. That is, he had had to take him firmly by the elbow. Then, after he took Svea's body to the chapel, 20 or more youngsters went out to her place, apparently, and dug great holes all over the yard. By the time the sheriff reached the place, the boys had tipped over Svea's outhouse and were prodding the hole, looking for money. Another boy and girl had got hold of power augers and were drilling into the frozen ground like mining prospectors among the stacked snow treads and fence wire wheels. The sheriff pulled them all in on possession and vandalism and then let them out again. He called Jack and said he was going to ask the state patrolman to help keep an eye open for the next couple days. "If we are going to have any trouble," Jack told him, "it will be during visitation days, not at the funeral itself." The two men talked to each other quietly on the telephone in the special measured way of people holding the fort for decency and dignity, while all the others gave in to some horrible craze. The sheriff said with a sigh, "Well, we'll manage. I've got to locate that nephew of hers now, wherever he is." Jack felt the respect the sheriff had for him, a funeral director, and the disrespect he had for Marlon Huftula, who never had worked a steady job in the wintertime if he could help it. Like half the men of St. Aidan, Marlon kept a line of traps somewhere out east along St. Aidan Creek. Once he had tried to bribe the sheriff out of a speeding ticket while the sheriff stood at his car window writing. Marlin had picked up the rabbit lying on the passenger side and passed it up to the sheriff. The sheriff had been busy writing, so he didn't look carefully. All he saw was white fur and a little blood. At home, his shepherd had just had a new litter of white puppies, so he mistook this animal. It was a full minute before he saw it was a rabbit, not a puppy. He had been writing a warning. Now he tore up the yellow card and gave the man a citation instead. All day, as he later told Jack, his stomach churned. Then he blushed. "I don't guess that would bother someone in your line of work," he added. "Yes, it would bother him," Jack told him. "I never had much tolerance," the sheriff said. Jack Cannon felt less tolerant every day now. He had started an adult education course 2 weeks ago. He thought it would give him perspective, but it was just the opposite. Now he minded remarks he heard that previously he would have passed off as the kind of thing people say. He frequently thought of his crimson vinyl notebook that lay on his office desk. It was labeled Humanities, St. Aidan Adult Education Program, Molly Gallen, Instructor. Jack had never been a man who took notes on his life as it went by. Yet now, several times a day, he said to himself, sometimes even aloud, since he was a good deal alone, "I ought to put that into the red notebook," or "that ought to go into the red notebook if nothing else ever does." And he looked forward to Wednesday night, the night of his class. Tonight it was to meet in his office, as a matter of fact. That had come about because 2 weeks ago, on registration night, only one student had shown up to sign up for the humanities course, Jack himself. His teacher was a spare, graying woman with a white forehead who was unlike anyone he had ever known. He glanced over her head, her figure, her long hands with thin, unremarkable fingers, trying to say, "It is in the eyes," or "It is in the hands," or "It is in how she carries herself." But he knew all his guesses were wrong. She leaned against the second grade teacher's desk, and Jack sat cramped before her in a desk and chair combination, comfortable only for small children. They waited for others to appear. Through the schoolroom doorway, they heard shy voices, calls, remarks, people signing up for beginning knitting too, a continuation from the fall semester. No one else came at all. Presently, Mrs. Gallant explained that the guidelines of the course would allow the class to meet in private homes if the class so chose. The following Wednesday, there was a blizzard, but Mrs. Gallant made it on I-35 from St. Paul to the new St. Aidan Motel and to the school building. This time, she read off to Jack some of the course subjects approved in the guidelines. They might choose among ethnicity, sources of community wisdom, ethical consciousness in rural America, longitudinal studies of human success and failure, attitudinal changes toward death, or simply other. They agreed that the following Wednesday, since no one had showed up again this time, they might as well meet in Jack's office. He explained to her that she should walk round to the back of the chapel where the back door opened onto a concrete apron. It was kept clear of snow, he told her. In his years and years of single life, Jack had noticed that lonely people were either carefully groomed or remarkably grimy. He himself had to be immaculate at all times. It was a habit by the time he was 14, along with learning how to cover the phone. He would push his arithmetic problems against the chapel schedule board, keeping the phone where his left hand could raise the earpiece on the first ring. Then he spoke immediately and courteously into the flared mouth. By the time he was a senior in high school, he was used to nearly all the work of the chapel. He knew how to lift heavy weight without grunting, while wearing a white shirt, tie, and suit jacket. He learned to keep longing or anxiety from showing on his face. One October day in 1936, he was sitting on the football bench at St. Aidan High School. The big St. Aidan halfback sat down next to him just for a minute. Jack had been sitting there, knees together, chilled for an hour. The halfback, a great tall boy named Marlon Huhtala, dropped down beside him when he was taken out to rest a minute, and his body gave off heat and the glow of recently spent energy. It was nearly visible like a halo, that great hot energy field around the boy. Jack knew enough not to look at Marlon for more than a second. He must not let himself be mesmerized into staring like a rabbit at a successful boy, the way he had seen others do. So Jack had given Marlin a casual grin, and both of them had turned to watch the field. Then the coach snapped his fingers at Marlin, who jumped up right in front of Jack. The coach's arm went around the leather, misshaped shoulders. Jack overheard the friendly growl of instructions. The coach pointed onto the field with one hand, slapped Marlin's buttocks with the other, and the halfback's back swung away toward the players, his socks sunk below his calves, jiggling in folds around the strong ankles. For the thousandth time that autumn, Jack expressed manhood by not letting his face look sad. But the next Thursday afternoon, just as he was helping his father transfer a casket from the nervous pallbearers into the hearse, Jack recalled the bad moment on the football field. His face jerked upward in embarrassment at the memory. When his father had closed the hearse doors, he pulled Jack aside. St. Aidan Lutheran's two bells kept tolling to the sound, so the sound rang down nearly on top of them. The sidewalk was white and cold with afternoon sunlight. "I'm going to tell you this just once, but it is very important," Jack's dad said. "Do not put on a fake sad look, the way you did just now when we were taking the casket. Get this straight. They don't expect you to look sad, just professional. Just keep your face serious and considerate." Jack became more and more carefully gauged in his appearance. He controlled his face, he maintained his grooming. But Svea Istava, whose body now lay in his operating room, had turned dirty as she aged. When Jack first knew her in 1943, she was a handsome woman of 39 or so. She told him she had to give up the St. Paul house that her husband's officer paid had been financing. She asked Jack if the World War II dead were going to be returned to the United States. Next month, she bought an old, very small farmhouse on an acre of scrubland about a mile past St. Aidan. The first time Jack went out there to visit, his eye passed over the turquoise-painted fake tile siding. He saw the string of barbed wire that someone had hitched to one corner of the outhouse and then stretched over to the corner post of the house itself. He supposed that Mrs. Istava would gradually have trash removed from the farmyard. He hoped she would find enough money to put in plumbing. He imagined the huge shade of the oaks darkening not these piles of rejected auto batteries and other trash, but new lawn. There was a distant view of both church spires, and to the north lay the pleasant, spooky pine forest. To his surprise, Svea didn't remove the barbed wire. She took to leaning things against it. First a screen door that warped and she couldn't repair. Next a refrigerator that stopped working. Its rounded ivory corners and its rusted base grate seemed natural after a while. Svea tied a clothesline length about it so that Momo Friesman would not climb inside and be killed. Sometimes she stood the way poor rural people stand, elbow bent, one hand planted on one irregular hip, and the face gazing vaguely past the immediate farmyard as if to say, "There is life beyond this paltry place. I have my eyes on it." In those days, Jack sometimes thought he would save Svea from all that. He imagined himself in a square-shouldered way driving out one miserable winter night when the sky would be black and the ground storming of down snow nearly blinding. "Oh, how did you ever make it on such a night?" she would cry, and he would say briefly, a little sharply, "Come on, we're going to town. We're going to be married." He imagined the reliable Willis pushing through all that darkness and whiteness. It never happened. Svea never called a junk man to pick up anything in her yard. Instead, more junk arrived. Jack had to pick his way to the doorstop over corrugated tread wheels of broken lawnmowers. Often, Momo stared at him from a pile of rubbish near the tipped refrigerator. He knew the child trapped mice and then buried them in a distracted, faithful way among Svea's onion sets and carrots. As the years passed, a rumor grew up that all of this was while Svea Istava had been and still was worth $500,000. The more unlikely her person and possessions, the more entrenched the myth. Meanwhile, gradually, Jack began to lose confidence. he began buying more and more expensive clothing. By the 60s, even his garden gloves were from L.L. Bean. He was the first man in St. Aidan to have a wool suit after a decade of dacrons and polyester. By accident, he found out what was wrong with him. One evening, he sat with the sheriff down at the station. It had been a bitter February day, as it was now, and the sheriff was saying that the bad news in St. Aidan County was the rising crime rate, but the good news was that more and more uranium leases were being let out around the area. Jack listened idly, leaning comfortably against the iron radiator, watching the heat move the window shades a little. The sheriff held several puppies on a pillow in his lap. His hands kept passing over the little dogs, and the dogs kept rearranging themselves in a whining, growling, moving pile of one another. As Jack looked on, he felt that he was losing confidence because he wasn't touching other live bodies enough. He watched in an agony of envy as the puppies wandered with their fat paws onto one another's eyes and ears and stomachs. He got the idea that they were gaining confidence from one another every time they touched. The next day he walked into the Farrell Cafe to have lunch with the New Haven funeral supply salesman, Bud Menge. Haunted by the revelation of the puppies, he sensed that women looked up at Bud Menge as he went by and rearranged their buttocks in the booths. Bud was friendly right from the first. After a year of their acquaintance, Jack said, "Couldn't you ever stop and let me buy you lunch without you trying to sell me something?" Most dealing in St. Aidan took place at either the Men's Fellowship of St. Aidan Lutheran or at lunch in the Farrell Cafe. Bud's face grew grave and considerate. "Listen, Jack, how would you like to discuss something that is absolutely new and different and will revolutionize your whole approach?" In 10 minutes, Bud sold Jack an industrial psychology program that he has used ever since. The casket showing room lighting plan, like all of Bud's ideas, was disgusting from the outset. "That's really revolting, Bud. Let's face it, Bud," he had said. "That's just about the worst taste I have ever heard of." Jack had often made such remarks during Bud's first year as representative of Haven Funeral Supply. Later, he was slower to speak. Bud never presented him an idea that was not absolutely profitable. The first aspect of the casket showing room lighting plan was simple. You lighted only those caskets you wanted a client to inspect. You placed small wall-bracketed lamps at 6-foot intervals along the two long walls and across one short end wall of the showing room. These lamps had either rose or cream shades. You lit only those you wanted on each given occasion. Jack generally lighted the caskets that went with a $1,500 service, the $2,300 service, and the $4,000 service. No one in St. Aidan's ever bought the $4,000 service, and in fact, it was not for sale. The $4,000 casket was an elaborate part of Bud's lighting plan. Jack saw that it was lighted and left its cover up, but did not lead clients over to it. Bud explained the procedure. People shopping for caskets feel that they are likely to be cheated by the mortician. Even if the mortician is a fellow small-town citizen whom they have known for years, they still feel they must watch him like a hawk now that they are buying from him. They know perfectly well that their own harrowed feelings at the time of a death are the funeral director's pivot. They are on tiptoe against his solemnity. Therefore, Bud explained, clients want to wander around the showing room on their own. They feel they are getting around the funeral director if they look at caskets besides the ones he seems to want to show them. They want to be shrewd. Eventually, Bud explained, because it is lighted and open, the $4,000 casket catches the client's eye. He goes over and, wonder of wonders, finds this casket to be noticeably more elegant than anything the funeral director has shown him so far. Immediately, he thinks it is probably priced the same as the caskets he has been shown, but simply is a better buy. He suspects it is being kept for some preferred customer of the funeral director, and that a comparative lemon is being pawned off on him at the same price. Bud told Jack, "You follow them over to the $4,000 casket, but stay behind a little, as if you didn't really want to go over there." How come you never showed us this one, they will ask. How come you never showed us this one when it is just beautiful, they will say. So then you tell them, you're right. It is the most beautiful one by far. It is the best casket we have ever had in Canon Chapel. Just tell them that much at this point. Let them hang a little. Sooner or later, the client will stop staring at you and will say, so how come you didn't show it to us? Now here is where you pull your act together, Bud told Jack. You tell them fairly fast, because I don't want you to buy that casket is why. Bud begged Jack to pause again right at that point. Stick with the pauses, Jack. I'm telling you, pause right there. Every single client, I don't care if it is the middle-aged mother with an only son who has just died, every single client will say, but why didn't you want me to buy it? What does it cost? Now you go right up to the client and say, because it costs $4,000. I know you can afford $4,000, Mrs. So-and-so. I know you can easily raise that amount. Money isn't the problem. The reason I don't want you to buy it is that I'd a hundred times rather, that you bought the $2,300 casket and give the other $1,700 to church or charity in memory of, and you insert the deceased name here. I'd 100 times rather you spend the $1,700 extra that way than on a casket. Okay now, Jack, here's the third pause. Don't make it very long, just a short one. Now you say, or does that sound crazy from where I'm supposed to be coming from? Bud was right. No client ever said, yes, it sounds crazy. Men gave Jack a warm look and sometimes slapped his arm. Women sometimes came around the $4,000 casket and hugged him. Everyone said, thanks, Jack, for being so square with us. And just as Bud had prophesied, not one of those clients ever bought the $1,500 casket. They all bought the $2,300 one. The whole point of the lighting plan was to switch people from the $1,500 to the $2,300 casket. During the whole sales procedure, Jack never had to lie. After explaining the plan, Bud had paused briefly, then looked very straight at Jack across the strewn cafe booth table, with the chili bowls and the paper sachets of coffee whitening chemicals that both men had pushed away so they could lean forward on their forearms. Some of them, Bud said, I wouldn't bother to explain, they don't have to lie. They wouldn't care. But with you, Jack, now, that's a major thing. The last point of the casket lighting plan was to have one end of the showing room nearly dark. Jack made use of this point right now. He broke into the quarreling between Estonia and Marla Huttula. Folks, Jack said loudly, I'm going over to look at some odds and ends of paperwork. I'll be down at the other end of the room, so when you want me, give a call. Clients need a sense of quarreling privately. They need to confer over how little they could spend without causing talk in a town. Talk about how cheap they were after all that he or she had done for them, too. Jack always left people to have this quarrel, but he stayed within earshot so he could return at the right moment. At a tiny writing table at the dark end of the room, just behind the county casket, Jack looked over an 8-page booklet showing full-color photographs of funeral customs all over the world. The photographs were on the right-hand pages, the discussion questions on the left-hand pages. What's the good of it, Jack had said in the Faro Cafe when Bud passed him the booklet across their coffee cups. It's the most practical thing we have come up with yet, Bud told him with his frank smile. It solves the problem of the local necrophiliac, and every town has one. Jack said, I wish you wouldn't use that word in the Faro Cafe, Bud. In fact, I wish you wouldn't use it at all. And besides, he added in the no-nonsense tone he used when he had to, his mind picturing Momo Friesman, we haven't got anyone like that in St. Aidan. Every town has one, Bud said. If you haven't got him today, you will have him tomorrow. When some funeral director tells me his town doesn't have one, I look at the funeral director himself. Ha ha, just joking, Jack. Bud opened the booklet to a page called Funeral Practices of the Frahiti People. Okay, he said, here's how it works. Your man shows up at a visitation or a wake. And who are the Frahiti people? What do we care? Said Jack. Bud grinned. How should I know who they are? They don't live around here anyway. Anyway, there's somebody. Some sociologist or humanities people or somebody did all the research. We know it's okay. That's a point I'm glad you asked about. You know, the research in this booklet didn't come from our publicity department like most of the stuff. This is the real thing. You can be confident when you use this. Anyway, your guy comes up at the wake, so you go up to him and you put your arm around his shoulder. The nice teaching ways a football coach throws his arm around you. And you feel good because you know the coach is taking you into his confidence, okay? Didn't you say you played football for St. Aidan High? Okay, then you know what the way I mean. Now with your free hand, Jack, you flip open this booklet. It is easy because they put this Brahidi people discussion at the center where the stapling is, so it naturally opens right there. So you keep your other hand on his shoulder, see, and you just show him this picture, the one you see there, with the jungle huts in the background and them carrying the corpse in a kind of a thatch-covered chair, with the feet hanging off like that towards us, and the discussion questions at the left. So you don't have to tell this person, look at the terrific picture of a dead body with the feet hanging off and that kind of coolie chair or whatever it is. Whatever you get to say aloud is, I wonder so-and-so. You want to use their name as much as you can, Jack, as you know. Hey, so-and-so, I wonder if you'd look through this new book and read these discussion questions. Maybe this is something that would help families through grief. Would you look this over and tell me what you think? And Jack, all the time you are seeing all of this, his eyes are glued to that picture and his mind is thinking, if people like that think. There are other full-color pictures in this book too, and I want to see them all. Then he hears you offering to let him take the booklet home with him. Now all this time you are pushing him right along out of your funeral chapel, and he is halfway home before he realizes he is no longer at the visitation. And that is fine with you. The last thing you need is someone trying any sensitivity games at a visitation. Bud gestured toward the booklet in Jack's hand. That little item may not have a lot of class, like our bronze desk accessories and all, but it is 100,000% effective. Now, Jack sat at the dark end of the showing room, looking at the dead Brahidi in the photograph. The man's feet, whitened in the foreground, in sharp focus, were separated from the gloomy jungle village in the background. Come to meet the viewer, the straw hut roofs, the gnarled equatorial trees, the smudgy broken grass of the village street, all that receded and lowered behind like a cloud departing. Jack heard Estonia Hutala's voice rise in fury. He was used to family differences in his showing room, but this one was especially nasty. He listened, trying to decide when he should break in. I don't see how you can be so uncaring, Estonia was shouting. You know that when they open up that will, there will be a half million for you, probably for you alone, too. You won't even have to share it with me, since you did such a good job making up to Svea all those years. You know what people will say, Marlon. They'll say that that nice aunt left him a cool half million, and all he would buy her was the county casket. I never said I wanted to buy Svea the county casket, Marlon shouted back. The casket they referred to was a narrow, light blue coffin that St. Aidan provided for welfare clients when the family could afford nothing else. It was nicely made, but most funeral directors, including Jack, made sure it was locally referred to only as the county casket, so that no one would contemplate buying it for a loved one. All I meant was, Marlon said, why go to $2,300 when we can get the same service and a perfectly nice-looking casket for $1,500? Jack rose from his small desk. Estonia said, that's going to look just fine, isn't it, when you get all that money? I call it downright cheap. Marlon grumbled, we don't even know if Svea had any money anyway. All the worse for you then, cried Estonia with a slashing laugh. All those Sunday afternoons you put in for nothing, sitting there in her filthy kitchen, not letting her tell you how Chuck Knoll should do this, Chuck Knoll should do that, and how old age comes even to the football players, and how Cliff Stout was a fool to hurt his arm. That one time I was there, you must have said it 20 times if you said it once. You may have something there, Svea. I nearly puked. And everything that goes up has to come down, I guess, Svea, even Lynn Swan. If you weren't the sponging wise nephew of the sports expert aunt, and the two of you drunk as lords before 3 in the afternoon, too. I nearly threw up listening to you. I'd say puke, except we're in a funeral chapel. Jack generally let relations quarrel until both of them had turned their irritation by mere exhaustion from each other to him. As soon as he felt all the anger coming towards him, none left for each other, he could spend a minute deliberately hard-selling a coffin he knew they didn't want. Then they would concentrate on outwitting this awful funeral director for a minute or so. He let them outwit him. Then he decided which coffin they would really like and usually wrapped up the sale, including the choice of remembrance folders, in 15 minutes. The clients left in harmony with each other, which was good. The moment they left Cannon Chapel, the elation of having stumped the mortician would die, and they would notice and carry their grief again. And another thing, Estonia cried, you know, if you had really respected Svea's dignity in life or in death, you wouldn't have been out tomcatting the very night after they found her, would you? There we were, the sheriff and I, trying to figure out where you were with all those kids having dug up poor Svea's yard and all. Do you know that the sheriff sent the deputy down the river because they thought you were checking your tracks? Finally, Mrs. Friesman said she had seen you driving somewhere with that Mrs. Galen from the adult education. Oh, I said, he wouldn't be with her. She always stays with us at the new St. Aidan Motel. Well, yes, she saw you, though, and she said, so what could the sheriff do? He drove back out to your house, and there you were in the middle of the night, the both of you. Of course, I'd made a fool of myself, telling the deputy I knew you wouldn't be running around with her, because she seemed like such a nice widow lady and very intellectual. Jack now made his way slowly from the dark end of the room, like someone a little off balance. He approached the brother and sister standing under the yellow wall lights and took Estonia by the elbow. He explained that they would now go into his office and have a sip of something that he kept, which sometimes helped people in times of grief. He led them around behind the chapel, past the door leading to the operating area, and into his office. Sunlight poured in, dazzling after the draped and shadowy showing room. Jack seated Estonia on the couch, he put Marlon in the conference chair, and opened a bottle of Pinot Blanc. Although everyone in St. Aidan knew that Estonia Huttala turned on the no part of the no vacancy sign at the motel each night around 10 and settled on with a whiskey, Estonia said, I don't use much alcohol, Jack, but a little wine would help me, I think. Estonia then allowed they ought to get the 2300 white-lined casket instead of the 1500 tan-lined one because it would be more cheerful for Svea to look out of. Both men looked out through the faint window curtains when she said that. She added, or maybe that's just me. In the normal course of things, Jack would have let Estonia sell Marlon on the more expensive of the two caskets, but now he wanted this old high school classmate and his sister out of the office so badly, he would have sold him a co-op burial club service with a pine box for $34.50 if they would just get out. So he took it into his own hands, ignoring Estonia, who was tapping her glass for a refill. He spoke to Marlon in a man-to-man tone, making fast explanations. He filled the man in on some of the side services provided in a funeral, such as getting police cooperation in case there was further trouble, or unwanted crowds to see the body of a simple old woman worth $500,000. He explained that his own man, Laverne Holpe, would park cars, assisted by the chapel man from Merrill Lake. Marlon responded exactly as Jack wanted. He tried to be snappy and intelligent, too. Marlon never mentioned the $1,500 casket again. Then, just when Estonia was beginning to look as if she felt neglected, Jack passed her the new remembrance format that Bud Menge had brought over only the week before. Gone was a 23rd Psalm in Old English, 11-point, on the left-hand side. Instead, there was a passage from The Velveteen Rabbit, in modern face, without Sarah. Jack said to Estonia, cutting Marlon out of it, Estonia, I want your honest opinion of these. If you don't care for this new style remembrances, say so. We will have the others printed up for Svea. At last, brother and sister were gone. Jack telephoned Laverne to say that he could come over and work any time now. He himself would have a catnap. he lay down on a small office sofa. The winter sun, very bright and low at this time of year, sent its long webby light through the glass curtains. Jack fell gratefully asleep, still wearing his suit jacket. Sunlight fell onto his desk with all the accessories Bud had provided him. The bronze-toned plastic paperweight imprinted Canon Chapel, care when care matters most. The sun fell onto his red-covered humanities notebook, too. It fell onto his own face and made his white hair nearly transparent and his skin luminous. Once during the following hour and a half, his young assistant, Laverne, looked in soundlessly and thought how sad the human face looks asleep. He decided that Jack Cannon, in his opinion anyway, led a very crappy life. Laverne decided he could manage the job without waking the fellow and called Greta at the beauty parlor when he was done to tell her she could come over and do Mrs. Estiva's head now or whenever she was ready. In his dream, Jack went to spend the weekend in a motel north of St. Paul. He was to meet a woman there who had exclaimed, "My God, I think I'm falling in love again. I love you, John." So long as Jack still believed she would show up, he patrolled the motel room, swerving around the ocean-sized bed and rounding the television set like an animal. Once he had decided she was not going to show up, he took to rereading all the materials in the desk except the Bible placed there by the Gideons. Everything he read swam and enlarged and darkened in his eyes. Everything had color swimming at the edges. Even the papers he held were yellowed like church windows on Christmas cards. He read through the room service menu with its appalling prices, and his eyes swam with tears. He read the daily cleaning services options with his eyes silvered with tears. He was reminded of something that someone at a Minnesota funeral director's convention had once told him. The man said that when he became born again, for the first few weeks, whenever he opened up the Bible, no matter at what place he opened it, his eyes would fill with tears. Jack was thinking that over in his dream when he waked to Laverne's tapping on the office door. Laverne put his head around the door. "All set now, Jack," he said. "I'll be going home now." "Oh, then you're ready for me," Jack said, trying not to sound slowed with sleep. "No, it's all done," Laverne told him. "Greta's here working now." Jack lay vulnerable in this huge sadness of his dream. The day was nearly over. All morning he had longed for the day to be over because it was Wednesday, the night of his class. Now the joy was gone out of it. Eventually, he rose and bathed and shaved and put on the best sports jacket he had. He looked at his gray eyes very carefully in the mirror, but it was okay. None of the dream or his own feelings showed. He locked the front door of the chapel, making sure the twin lights for visitation were both turned off. People understood by that Svea could not be viewed until the next day. Then he went round and lighted the rear yard light, which fell upon the private entrance to his office and the garage. At nearly 8 o'clock, the bell rang. Jack cried to himself, "She came after all then." He swung the door open to the cold night. Outside, Momo Friesman stood on the garage cement, his bulging eyes bright from the overhead light. "I came to pay my respects to Mrs. Estiva," said Momo quickly. "And don't you turn me away, Jack. I got a right. She was neighbor to me, and my mother and I was friends. She had me come to keep her company once a week, and I got a right to mourn her as good as anyone else." "Visitation isn't until tomorrow, Momo," Jack said. Then he recalled Bud Mench's little book of photographs and discussions. "There is something you could help me with, though, Momo. Do you have time to come in a minute?" Momo's eyes shone. "I can help you in the lab, Jack." "No," said Jack firmly, "not in the operating room, but wait." He started to go into the casket showing room for the booklet, but then remembered he couldn't leave Momo alone or the man might leap through the office door toward the operating room. So he put his arm around Momo's shoulder and led him to the sofa. When he saw Momo was all the way seated, he left. Momo had the face of a 12-year-old. He was 43, in fact. Every morning in the summer, his mother drove him into town, and Momo went through all the trash disposal cans in St. Aidan, recovering Minneapolis Tribunes from them, and sold them up and down the street of the town, shouting, "Paper! Paper!" All the business people sent someone out, a receptionist or whoever was nearest the door, to give Momo a nickel and take a paper. When he had gone the whole length of the street, from the Cannon Funeral Chapel at the one end to Rocky Mountain Prospector's office at the other, he would find more papers lying on top of the trash cans, so he sold them again, this time to the other side of the street. At noon, he waited among the boxes that came into the Red Owl of the truck. The owner would shout, "He's here, okay, Mrs. Friesman," when his mother came to pick him up. Once a week, she took him over to Svea Istva's place across the road, and Svea would let him dig in her pile of orange crates and used winter tires. When Jack dropped the booklet into Momo's lap, it opened his budded promise to the photograph of the dead Fahiti man in his grassy chair. Jack thought to himself, "It is 8:05 now. She hasn't shown up. She's not going to come." Well, he went on to himself, everyone has to have some kind of memorial made in their honor. We shouldn't any of us die without someone doing at least something in our honor. Jack looked down at Momo, who was bent over the photograph. Well, Momo, Jack thought, you're it. Svea let you into her place all those years. Tonight, then, I will let you into mine. You can sit there and gloat over that book for 2 hours if you want. Jack went and sat down at his desk. He said in his thoughts, I don't suppose you'd understand, Momo, if I tried to explain to you that Molly Galen was supposed to be sitting here where you are sitting, not you. Well, anyway, it isn't her, it's you. Jack remembered how Svea remained kind to Momo, even when, 2 weeks after her dog Biscuit died, Momo found the grave, despite the rusty refrigerator grill Svea had laid on top of it in hopes that he wouldn't notice. Momo dug up Biscuit and brought the body into the house and laid it on Svea's oilcloth-covered table. Biscuit looked bad after 2 weeks in here. Even then, Svea did not lift a hand to Momo. She only telephoned Jack to ask if he ever had any difficulty with Momo around the chapel. Jack confessed that he had to deal with Momo on various occasions. Now he went through the little speech Bud had taught him, suggesting Momo take the booklet home. He need not have bothered. Just as Bud predicted, Momo was entranced by the pictures. The doorbell rang again. Jack went over to it, nearly faint with hope, but still unbelieving. I didn't know if I ought to come, Molly Galen said. I know you have had a death. Oh, but visiting isn't until tomorrow, Jack cried. He held the door wide, but didn't offer his arm. Molly Galen explained that she was a little breathless from having walked over from the motel. Then Jack remembered Momo. Mrs. Momo Friesman, Jack said. He went over and stood near Momo's knee. Momo is going to zip up his jacket now and take his book home before it gets even later and colder. I want to stay here, Momo said. Let's see your book, Molly said. You give that back, he told her. I promise, she said. She sat down beside him, turning the pages. And now you must take it home with you, Momo, Jack said. But first you must zip up your jacket, because it is much colder again now. Jack realized that in 1 minute Momo would be out of there. And that thought made him so joyous, he nearly danced the man into his zipper. I don't want to go, Momo said. Jack thought, I could just strangle him until those eyes jumped clear out of his head like twin pale spheres careening out into space, and then I would pick him up and throw the whole masses of a man out the door. As soon as Jack noticed what he was thinking, he backed further from the sofa. Anyway, he thought, retreating to the desk, what did he care if Momo chose to stay the evening? What good would it do now to have an evening with Molly Galen? Oh yes, he cried to himself, look at that flushed face of hers and that lively look in her eyes. That isn't from hiking over here in the cold, and her wonderful smile. That smile was turned towards Momo, but how could such a smile be for Momo? Women of 50 did not look like that, except when love was so recent the body itself still remembered it. Jack's anger narrowed and cooled and felt permanent. And anyway, he added to himself, all this is just a job of work for a woman like her. She was hired to tutor adult extension students in the humanities, so she tutored adult extension students in the humanities. She had agreed to meet in his office, probably because this arrangement was simpler than anything else. He said aloud, "Well, if Momo wants to stay, that would be all right, wouldn't it?" She looked at Momo and said, "Of course, Momo, you can read your book and we'll work on ours." "And afterward, I will pay my respects to Svea," Momo told her. "Now tonight," she said, "when I say it's time, you will zipper up your jacket and you can walk home with me." In the meantime, Jack walked rapidly back and forth between his lighted desk and the sofa. Perhaps Molly Galen was going to open her copy of the Red Humanities workbook over there on the sofa beside Momo. She might do that, he supposed. But she didn't. She came to his desk and sat down in the conference chair. She picked up a bronze marker stamped Canon Chapel and laid it back quickly. She said, "The extension people would like to know what subject we're going to work on, and they want us to write an evaluation as we go along. This is a kind of pilot program, you see," she smiled at him. "They want to know what your expectations are." How could Jack tell her his expectations? All week he had planned how she was coming, and he meant to tell her part of his life story. Shamelessly, he had meant to. Jack had meant to tell her how all his life he had wished to be serious. Not just solemn, as he must be at his work, but serious. He wanted to tell her how here in St. Aidan, where he practiced a trade he'd never wanted to practice, somehow he could not rise over the chaff and small cries of daily life into some upper ring of seriousness. He imagined this ring of seriousness, like Saturn's rings, almost physically circling the planet, but he couldn't reach it because he was caught down here, blinded in the ground storming of old jokes, old ideas, old conventions, which no sooner were dropped than they were picked up again like snow, lifted and lifted and dropped and lifted again by blizzard wind, blowing into everyone's face over and over. Molly Galen smiled at him. She had placed the four fingers of her right hand between the five pages of the humanities notebook, and she held these pages apart as if ready for reference. He saw the lamplight through the spread pages like a nearly translucent eastern fan, collapsible, of course, but taking up its space as elegantly as sculpture does. Jack thought, how can it be that anyone with such hands spent last night with Marlon Huhtala? How can that be when Marlon Huhtala all his life has never done anything admirable except play halfback for St. Aidan in 1936? And Jack saw, as sharply as his mind's eye had ever seen it, Marlon's sweaty hair as he removed his leather helmet. Now Jack bent toward Molly under the beautiful lamplight and shouted at her, "What I want to know is, why did you ever do it? How could someone like you go and go and, oh, how could someone like you, for the love of God, go and spend the night with Marlon Huhtala? How could you do it?" "I know I did not just say that aloud," Jack told himself. "I know I did not." "Nonetheless, that is what I just did. However, I must not have really said that aloud, because men in their 60s do not ask humanities consultants why they spent the night with whomever they spent the night with. Yet it was my voice that said that." And then he thought, in 1 minute she will simply rise and leave without another word. She will go over to the couch and pick up her coat where she left it near Momo, and she will leave. I shall offer her a ride home because it is so cold again, and oh Christ, she will refuse even that. Mm-hmm. However, the ladylike fingers did not fold up the fan. Molly Galen shouted at him, I don't know why I did it, and what do you care anyway? I don't care what you do, Jack said. Well, Molly shouted, you just don't know how dumb it all is. And she burst into tears. Very far inside himself, in a place really too dank to nourish a spark of happiness, Jack felt a tiny warmth. What do you mean, dumb? He asked. But then the snarl came back into his voice. So what's that supposed to mean, dumb? What is that supposed to mean, how dumb it all is? Anyone can go around shouting things like that. You don't know what it is to be lost in the dumbness of it, she shouted, still crying. You chose it, you chose it, he said. You chose Marlon Huhtala. Suddenly then, her hands fell simply, faintingly, like snow, onto the booklet in her lap. Her face and voice suddenly were completely serene. Yes, she said, pausing. That's right, she said in an agreeable, logical tone. Marlon Huhtala. Now, he really is dumb. She added in an even more peaceful tone, that is a fact, you know. He really is very dumb. The dumbest person I ever knew, Jack said. But then he leaned forward and said, what do you mean exactly? He felt a hope taking fire in him too quickly. He did not want to lose his proper anger in this hope. Already he noticed that Molly was sitting with her head tipped to one side, nearly daydreaming at him, and he too, on his side of the lamplight, was tipping his head at the same angle. They regarded each other like two birds with the great concentration and the great natural stupidity of birds. Hope kept rising rather weakly in Jack, like a hand rising from a lap, with the fingers still falling from the rising wrist, the fingers flowing downward like an umbrella. Momo, meanwhile, had approached them and now wavered, his face turning from one to the other of them. Jack whispered, well, will we go on with the course, do you think? Molly said, of course we will. Jack said briskly, it is too cold for you and Momo to walk home. I will drive you both. Momo, it is time for you to zip your jacket now. The telephone rang. It was the sheriff. Jack, I thought you would like to know. The Huhtala family read Svea Istava's will early. And you know what? She didn't have 2 cents to her name after all that fuss. So what we'll do, Jack, the Marrow Lake patrolman and I will keep an eye out the next couple of days, and we'll make sure the news gets around, so you shouldn't have any crowd draw to the visitation hours. I expect you'll just get the usual for an old woman like that. In the background, Jack could hear the sheriff's puppies barking. Jack and Momo and Molly all sat in the front seat of his car. The night had dropped below zero, so their breathing frosted the windshield and the side windows as well. The defroster opened up only a small space in the windshield directly in front of Jack. He had to hunch down to see through it. He guided the car gingerly through the cold town out on the north road toward the Friesmans. The black woods were not wrecked, but they were nearly wrecked. The greater trees had been cut over. The earth under the forest was not wrecked either, but it was staked out. Here and there, invisible to ordinary people, were concrete stoppered holes where the uranium prospectors had pulled out their pipes and left only magnets so they could find their places again. As the car crawled along the iced highway, Jack thought of the whole countryside, nearly with tears in his eyes. He kept peering through the dark, clear part of the glass with his whole body shivering and his skin cold in his gloves, and the whole of him beginning to flood with happiness. His own life, Jack thought, it wasn't completely wrecked after all. It felt to him, since he was 63 and much was over for him, or rather, much had gone untraveled, that his life was nearly wrecked. But not completely. He began to smile behind his cold skin. He started driving faster, feeling more jaunty and more terrific every second. The patrolman from Merrill Lake, who had just left the St. Aidan station, happened to see the car tearing along Old 61 where it crossed the North Road. He thought, oh boy, traveler's advisory or no traveler's advisory, nothing stops some people. Car all frosted blind like that, tearing right along anyway. Behind the car's pure white windows, he did not make out the local undertaker and a comely woman and a middle-aged, retarded man. It's a very complicated, long story. I'm sorry it was so long. But, it's rich with stuff. What are your reactions?
Mm-hmm. take a long time to take this apart.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm sorry.
You could definitely run through it. Yeah. It's pretty complicated.
Yeah. Let's start with a question that I think is sort of important, which is the question about legacy. What does one leave behind? What are some clues that the story gives us about a legacy? You know, the author, Carol Bly, makes a point of telling us that she didn't have $500,000. There's a surprise, huh? Does anything come to mind about that? Does that seem like... it's not fruitful in your minds? How about the title, The Dignity of Life? Where does the dignity of life in this story come from? Is there dignity in life? Where does the dignity of life of Jack, the funeral director, come from? Some clues are early on, it talks about how he, when he was 14, he learned to cover his face over and look respectful and serious, or solemn. I guess he had to look solemn. And then it says, in his years and years of single life, Jack had noticed that lonely people were either carefully groomed or remarkably grimy. He himself had to be immaculate at all times. And then it talks about he knew how to lift heavy weight without grunting while wearing a white shirt, tie, and suit jacket. He learned to keep longing or anxiety from showing on his face. For the thousandth time that autumn, Jack expressed manhood by not letting his face look sad. Meanwhile, gradually, Jack began to lose confidence. He began buying more and more expensive clothing. By the 1960s, even his garden gloves were from L.L. Bean. You know, he was the first man who wore a wool suit. And then it goes on to say, by accident, he found out what was wrong with him. And that's the story about the puppies touching each other. And he decided that whenever you had contact with another living thing, it gave you confidence.
That's a good thought. That's a very good thought.
Yeah. He was, as Jack looked down, he felt that he was losing confidence because he wasn't touching other live bodies enough. He watched in an agony of envy as the puppies wandered with their fat paws onto one another's eyes and ears and stomachs. He got the idea they were gaining confidence from one another every time they touched. And then right after that is a scene where he likes this guy who sells him stuff about funerals, and he says, can't we have lunch together without you selling me something? And then the guy launches into another sales pitch. And then we hear that long description of all the ways that funerals, parlors, package death. And package death into a business. And the whole thing is a sort of effort to make us understand the sort of incredibly stylized and packaged and covered over way that this man lives and learns to live. But I think one of the legacies of Svea's death is that Jack recovers his life. Because somehow in that whole process, why does Jack allow Momo to stay at the end when he's still hopeful that his teacher is going to arrive? Do you remember what he said? He said, Svea let Jack let Momo come once a week for years and dig around in his yard and do whatever Momo did. And Jack is going to let Momo stay in his house for this night out of respect for Svea. as a legacy to her. Or as a sort of...
get the feeling that Momo is one of his few contacts that doesn't ask him to buy anything except perhaps a paper.
Yeah.
I think Momo in general, he plays a very important role. For a lot of people, they think he's an idiot or somebody, but he's very important because he is a connects to Svea, and she considers him as a normal person or treats him like any other person. And then Momo also has somehow a line to Jack, so he connects elements that don't have a connection otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very interesting that at the end, when you would sort of hope that Jack and his sweetheart would be together in the car, they'd have Momo there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He was not...